Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal form, from the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an
Good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Agitators Anonymous, episode 91. I am Alan Averill, just a singer in a heavy metal band, trying to make some sense of the things, well, that confuse me, etc., etc. Support the show at www.patreon.com/AlanAverill. All sorts of other interesting bits and pieces, demos, songs, rehearsals, that kind of thing, etc., etc., as we get nearer and nearer to the 100 mark, and I'm still in season one. Who knew? Well, I knew. I told you that on episode one, that we would still be in a form of the same bleeding season, as they say. Anyway, episode 91 is a chat with a comedian called Leo Kurse. Leo is a rather vociferous and outspoken opponent of cancel culture, a supporter of free speech, pretty famous for not only his award-winning comedy, but his hilarious takes and takedowns. And you've probably seen him on terrestrial TV, even on those kind of talking head debates about, you know, does cancel culture exist around comedy and what constitutes free speech, this kind of thing. And also on his YouTube channel, and I no doubt if you've got a certain kind of algorithm, he pops up all the time. You may have seen his contributions to Podcast of the Lotus Eaters. He's been on Kurt Metzger's podcast, all sorts of other things. It's a pretty interesting chat, and Leo is an affable dude, and I really had a good time talking to him. And hopefully we'll be able to get a few other interesting and odd people outside of the remit and world of metal and music to come onto the podcast in the coming months. It was just merely, I happened to be watching something, he popped up next, and I thought, that was pretty funny. And I think I'd just been in Scotland as well, and thought to myself, well, goddamn, if I can't ask a Scotsman about what the hell is going on up there and all that kind of thing. So here it is, without further ado. This is Leo Kurse.
Recording in progress. There you go. Hello, sir. How are you? We'll do this all again.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, well, surviving. I just sort of set myself that up before, which won't make any difference now, but I was going to just sort of, might as well start into all this kind of stuff without much of a preamble. But I sort of was saying to you in the email thread when we were exchanging emails that the sort of comedy world and the music world, at least heavy metal sort of for me, overlapped a bit. But some of the things that we saw coming in relation to metal arrived a couple of years later into comedy. So like 15, 20 years ago, we began to see cancel culture stuff slipping into metal. Mainly at the behest of middle-class punks who sort of moved into our scene and sort of went.
Right. What were people getting cancelled for?
Well, what was happening basically, in my opinion, was that heavy metal was sort of traditionally working class, and punk, in my opinion, was sort of more middle-class, college-educated. And there was a moment in the 90s where punk was pretty musically redundant and metal, or black metal, whatever you want to call it, wasn't. And a lot of people gravitated sideways into metal and then went, well, look at these idiots. How can we educate them? And that's kind of where that's kind of how I see it. And so it's sort of, that sort of happened. And we started to see, at least in metal, like in the mid-2000s and late 2000s, calls for bands to be cancelled because, you know, I mean, there was, of course, the extreme metal flirtation with nationalism and stuff on some level, but a lot of it was just basically for being extreme, quote unquote. And so as it sifted into comedy, because there's very little overlap.
That's so weird. I mean, metal is a sort of a genre, like an art that is based on being extreme noise, you know, extreme. I mean, like you say, there's obviously some pretty unsavory political flirtation, certainly maybe more in the 70s and stuff with I guess like Screwdriver and people like that. But it's like, you know, it's an extreme, it's a real release of all that sort of anger and fury, but in a healthy way.
Yeah. And I think that, well, that's kind of, in my opinion, sort of something that went missing along the way. And it's kind of like, I remember, like I said, we have a sort of common mate, Steve Hughes, you know. And yeah, Steve used to play in my band 20 years ago. He stood in for a while and he was in this iconic band in the 80s. And the stuff that he was warning the comedy scene of happening, we'd of course been ringing the bell in the metal scene 15, 20 years ago. You know, but it's kind of weird how it kind of just shifted sideways. And now when we watch podcasts with you guys talking about what's happening in comedy, we sort of saw a vague shadow of that 10, 15 years ago, you know? It's kind of very strange.
Yeah, and it's weird how it manifests itself, and not just, you know, good comedians like Alistair Williams getting cancelled and, you know, really being unable to find venues to perform at, and also getting cancelled from YouTube, but also just in the way comedians think and act now. So I was at a comedy club with my mate Nico, who does the Three Speech podcast with me, and another comedian, so Nico's black, and another black comedian came up to him and said, Nico, the optics on your Twitter look far right, or look right wing. And Nico's like, Nico's just, you know, his family. He's got family, he's got kids, daughters. Yeah. So he worries about the stuff that's going to affect them, obviously, as you would as a parent. So, you know, and he's got some, you know, traditional family value stuff. And no, like, you know, he's a very open and accepting person. But just the fact that comedians are now thinking, like using the term optics, which, you know, previously would be used by a government spin doctor or somebody working in branding for a large corporation. And now you've got these artists, because comedians, musicians, supposed to speak from the heart, supposed to speak their own personal truth, have a raw, unfiltered honesty. I mean, personally, that's what I think, you know, if you're going to go see a musician, you're not expecting it to be focus group tested.
No.
But comedians have this attitude of this carefully stage managed persona and making sure you're not saying anything that could be offensive to any particular group. It's a kind of worrying trend. It puts so many filters between the sort of the person and the audience.
But why, I mean, I have my sort of opinions about why that might have happened in metal, as I said, or in extreme music. And I think some of it is to do with a sort of middle class, you know, sort of post-college attitude moving sideways into what was once a working class sort of pursuit or release. But I see something maybe similar happened in comedy, in the sense that because comedy became so huge, it went from underground cellars to literally playing to 10, 15,000 people. Many people saw that and went, oh, I could do that. But there were people who, A, weren't funny or didn't understand that comedy thrives in dark places. And that middle class sort of, you know, yoga mat comedy, that's not where it thrives. And then those people, of course, want to impose those sort of values onto the system that they've now decided belongs to them. That's kind of how it looks to me from the outside.
Yeah, I mean, there was in the 80s, I mean, what you say is correct. Comedy's traditionally been a sort of working class pursuit. It's not been recognized by the Arts Council, and it's, you know, you go around working men's clubs in the north of England and whatever, doing clubs like that. And it became, you know, with the movement for alternative comedy. Not that I'm saying, I'm not working class myself. I'm posh as fuck. But like when alternative comedy came about in the 80s, and you had Ben Elton and all these, you know, college educated comedians, the Mary Whitehouse experience in the 90s and stuff. So, you know, David Baddiel, and all the rest of it. So it became more meta, it became more self-referential, and became more, less raw, less sort of one-note direct comedy, and became smarter, basically, yeah. which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Stuart Lee, for all his faults, is a very funny comedian.
Yeah, yeah.
But it meant that, these people did start to impose their values on the values of traditional working class comedians. And obviously a lot of the sort of traditional working class comedians got sort of pushed to the side, not cancelled. And, Jim Davidson, Bernard yeah. Manning, all the rest of it became, Bobby Davro became much less employable than they used to be. And I think in a lot of cases, it was a sort of misinterpretation or a misunderstanding of the material. So, for example, comedians doing mother-in-law jokes, yeah. That's seen as some sort of misogynist, they hate women, it's like, you're punching down at this poor woman. It's totally the opposite. Working class families, the new husband would, the new husband and wife wouldn't have enough money to buy their own house straight away. So they'd go and live with the wife's family.
Yeah.
So, the guy, the mother-in-law, as the matriarch of the household, yeah. would be calling the shots and bullying the husband. Mm. So these mother-in-law jokes were just, they were kicking back, they were, punching back at that matriarchal power
yeah.
that the mother-in-law had. And they weren't, even though they're mean, that was the sort of, that's where it was coming from. It wasn't yeah. punching down, it was punching up. Right. This whole notion of punching down is something that, because society is now sort of systemically woke. Every aspect of society, yeah, yeah. society is woke. You even saw it in the legal system is woke now.
Yeah,
people were innocent of a crime yesterday, pulling down the Colston statue. That they definitely did. From a legal point of view, they definitely did it. But because it's seen as being on the right side of history, the system sort of got them off.
Yeah.
But, because everything's systemically woke, there's this safetyism.
Yeah.
So people, you see it with everything, face mask. You've got to wear a face mask for my safety. You've got to restrict your freedoms for my safety. And yeah. it's the same with comedy. This joke makes me feel unsafe. And previously, 50 years ago, health and safety meant, scaffolding falling on you or something
yeah, yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Now it means, getting butt hurt because somebody's done a joke. And because freedom, my freedoms end where they impinge on your safety. This sort of blossoming, this inflation of safetyism, restricts freedoms. And this sort of safetyism that's really throttling a lot of comedy at the moment. People have to second guess themselves. There's a lot of self censorship going on.
But that's really because, it just seems to be. Just to go back to something you sort of said at the start of that point is that I'm a fan of Stuart Lee. But if you take Stuart Lee, he's still anti-establishment, and that's what I find interesting. I think it's interesting to dig down to is that the '80s comedians, essentially, if you look back at the Rick Mayles and the people like that, Adrian Edmondson, they were anti-establishment. Whereas, and similar to some of the music scene now, is that the people who are, saying they support, or we would say have woke values, they want verification or they want support from the establishment. They aren't anti-establishment. Stuart Lee is still, I think, anti-establishment. But modern comedians, at least that I would see, or you would probably maybe call, woke or whatever, they seem to want validation and support and to be kept safe by the very institutions of power that
yeah.
once upon a time artists held to account. And that's something
yeah.
we said in the email thread, and I think that's a kind of good nucleus of a conversation, is what I don't understand, it's the same with music, is what happened to sticking it to the man? Is it because everybody
yeah.
wants to be the man now, or do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think people on the left think that the right have power. I mean, because ostensibly there is a conservative government. Well, I mean, there's supposed to be a conservative government. They don't seem to be very, very conservative.
No.
And people on the right think that the left have the power because, everything is systemically woke now,
yeah.
the BBC, but like everything, the decisions being made, through tech, academia,
yeah.
The arts, public sector, everything is run by left-wing people now. So, and I think both sides have got a point, but if you're looking at who's got the cultural power, it's definitely the left.
Yeah.
If you look at the BBC, of all the comedians on the BBC, who expressed a political point of view, 99% were left-wing and 1% were Jeff Norcott. So it really is that imbalanced.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And the alternative comedians of the 80s, so they were kicking back against the establishment, kicking back against, you know, these old men doing their sexist jokes.
Yeah.
And kicking back against, you know, Thatcher and all the rest of it.
Which is fair enough,
but they've become the establishment, but yeah. they don't see it. And all these new ones coming up. I mean, like you say, it's weird that people, you know, comedy music would traditionally be questioning the establishment, criticizing the establishment, and now they're like just reinforcing the stuff that the establishment says, like, oh, you must wear a face mask. You know, the government's telling you to wear a face mask. You must wear a face mask, and there's no dissent allowed. Like, no. If you don't wear a face mask, you're literally killing granny. Even though now people just aren't dying from coronavirus.
No, anymore. I mean it's that similar thing has happened in metal. Is that bands who sang about rebellion, or more interestingly, being opposed to faith, now carry water not only for trans multinational corporations or big pharma, but ask us to have faith in the very same institution they've been trying to rail against for 20, 30 years. And it breaks my brain, because I'm really sort of out on a limb opposite that. But I always stood there in relation to our scene for the last 20, 25 years. And it's like, oh, you're all on the other side of the fence now, but you're standing beside Pfizer or, and it sort of makes me wonder about the, all the sort of things that people sang about, I guess, were they didn't stand behind them, or they didn't mean anything anyway, or that people are just like your average person, scared into some sort of submission to the end, you know, 2 years of propaganda. I don't know. But it's very strange that even in extreme metal, people are following the same sort of mantra.
Yeah, yeah. And also in comedy, there's a big sort of people will, toe the line with, you know, what the multinational corporations say, so Pfizer, AstraZeneca, all the rest of it. They toe the line with what the government says, but they'll kick against the sort of the liberal institutions that preserve our freedoms and preserve our rights. So there's a lot of criticism of the British Empire. If you were to look at the output of comedy, you would think that all the British Empire did was subjugate people and destroy people. You'd think there's no positive, there's no sort of rule of law, or the right to a home life, right to privacy. There's no courts, and the right to a free trial. None of the good things that personally I associate with Britain and the British Empire. You think none of those came to pass, and Britain was just revolved around massacring brown people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we could, oddly enough, in a sort of weird paradox, it's something most people don't mention, is like medicine and, you know, that kind of thing, which came with empire, you know. But
yeah, like all empires, like, I mean, they take away people's freedoms to a certain extent, but they deliver huge benefits. Like the Roman Empire, when they came in, and they did it really cleverly, so they allowed people to keep their religion and all the rest. The Roman Empire only collapsed when they started enforcing, I guess it would have been, was it Christianity? Yeah, it must have been Christianity. Yeah. They used to let people keep their own religion and customs and all the rest of it. And they said, "And look, we're going to build these roads. We're going to build this sewage system and all the rest of it, and give you this, you know, this sort of power structure to have civilization. Yeah. And all you got to do is just give us some money, give us some of that food, and say anybody looks good at fighting, send them to us, and we'll train them to be fighters, or we'll make them kill giraffes in a big football stadium." And that was a great system. That was an empire that really worked. And I think the British Empire, you go to India or whatever, people have a lot of respect and a lot of love for Britain. The people who don't have a lot of love for Britain are the British people who've been to university.
Well, I mean, that's kind of it. It's got it. But I think it's something wider. I think it's like a sort of a cultural malaise or malady, a sickness, a sort of European, an internal sort of internalized academic European sickness, in the sense that there's no belief in the structures of European society, whether they were democracy or freedom of speech or all those kind of things, where we've sort of internalized this masochism, where we've decided that we absolutely hate ourselves. And it's been really sort of amplified the last 5 or 10 years. You know, I see it in my own scene as well. Whereas before, You could have, well, sang, I suppose it was, you could have sang about paganism, for example. And we see it in Netflix and programs like Vikings and that kind of scene. That's where my scene was sort of housed in that sort of, I suppose, a form of romantic paganist ideal or something like this, which slowly turned into something which was something to be moved into a sort of empirical view of being ashamed of. But even though it was, you know, 1,000 years before that or whatever. But it seems to me like there's a sort of collective sickness, which maybe was coming in the post, and it's been coming in the post for 50, 60 years. I don't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there's like, you know, people say that the seeds of this were sown in the universities by, you know, left-wing agitators and funded by the KGB to sort of destabilize Western democracy. Because it's interesting that wars are won and lost these days. Like going out to Vietnam, America ostensibly lost the Vietnam War militarily and politically. But culturally, you go there, man, it's all capitalism's everywhere. Yeah. And very, you know, really thriving economy. And you realize that culturally and economically, capitalism, the American values have won there. Yeah. Because people want to be free and they want to, you know, essentially people want to do what they want to do. Yeah. And for all that capitalism gets maligned, capitalism's really just, you know, all right, I've got this money, this resources, I want to do what I want to do with it, rather than what the government wants to do with it. And it always works better as a system because the government doesn't have a clue what it's doing. I used to work in government, and honestly, government should just be kept as small as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of libertarian ideal, really, isn't it, to have small government, which is the opposite of where we're headed now. And that's one of the things that I find kind of so grimly fascinating, is that I, you know, toured around the world a lot, and I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe, especially in the last 20, 25 years. I've been to Russia and Ukraine, I've been in, you know, Vietnam and Cambodia and stuff as well, but also into South America and Central America. And trying to tell some 22-year-old kid who idealizes, I suppose, it's just kind of a tradition to idolize, whether it was people like Che Guevara or something, but to idolize communism, to try and ring the bell and go, say to them, well, there's a lot of signposts about what's happening now during the pandemic where you're saying to people, this is a soft signpost to authoritarianism that I've seen in other countries. And other countries are people, because people listen to the podcast, everyone, they message me going, what the fuck are you guys doing in Europe, in the West? Have you turned democracy on its head in just under 2 years? And of course, oh no, Alan, come on. And you sort of try and say to people, I mean, one of my podcasts I did like 50 episodes ago was just like, democracy is not the default setting of society. And the fact that we think it is.
Oh, we're living in a very brief, like, you know, on a sort of chronological scale, very brief sliver of freedom and democracy compared to human history. Yeah. And people, this is the thing. I mean, I used to think that, you know, British people valued our freedom so much. You know, it was embedded in our DNA, and we'd never stand for people taking away our freedoms. Turns out, in lockdown, people loved having their freedoms taken away. They love having, feeling safe. They love the illusion of safety, you know, rather than the genuine safety of freedom. Yeah. So, I mean, although a lot of that was driven by the fact that they were getting 80% of their salary from the government to sit in their arse doing nothing.
Yeah.
When that goes away, I think, you know.
But that's a friend of mine said to me, he just said to me, and he was being very blunt about it. He just goes, mate, you played in a band for 30 years. You fucking skirted around the system. You travel the world, blah, blah, blah. And then everything got taken from you within 2 weeks of the pandemic. He goes, your average person, without sounding patronizing, worked a fucking job they hated for a boss, a middle management boss who fucking dumped on them. They now get paid 350, 300 quid a week to sit at home, smoke weed, play fucking PlayStation and fucking, I don't know, learn the sitar or something. They're like,
do what they want to do.
They're like, fucking great. And I was like, and he says, and they don't give a fuck that you are worried about freedom of speech or you're worried about all this kind of stuff. They're like, meh.
Yeah.
But, I see that at some stage, but I also think there's a percentage of people who, as you say, really are just fine with this. And that really breaks my brain.
Yeah, even the surveys that they did a survey, and there was like 20% of the people surveyed were happy with, you know, an 8 p.m. curfew, like ongoing, regardless of whether there's coronavirus or not.
That's what we have here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Everything is shut here at 8 p.m. I mean, we've had the longest and the strictest lockdown in Dublin, I think, than any capital city in Europe. And we had 1 month where things opened up a bit. I mean, we don't play here often with the band, but there's been no gigs. Yeah. And 1 month in 23, there's been, it's 8 p.m. right now, so I'm right in the city center. By 8:15, city's dead. And no, you know, like,
right, yeah,
like that for before Christmas or whatever. And it breaks my brain, of course, to think that, like, for a majority of people, this doesn't bother them at all. The fact that there's no, our history dictates that we sing about rebellion after three drinks and that this is the island of art and culture and musicians, and actually it's not. It seems to be a nation of people who are happy to just sit on the couch and watch Netflix.
Yeah, same with Scotland. Like in the film, Scottish people are all like, freedom! But yeah, in real life, they're like, oh, please, can you lock me into my own house? And even before lockdown, like the SNP, they've got so many just joy-killing, nitpickingly authoritarian rules. You can't buy beer in the shop after 10 p.m. Yeah, so I used to, drive up to Scotland and get there at 10:30. You can't buy a beer in Tesco. It's like, I'm a grown man.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm 29. I'm 45, but like, you know, I can't buy a beer in Tesco. Like, what do you think I'm going to do with this beer? I'm just going to drink it. You know what I mean? I'm not going to go out like jacking cars or anything. And the government, so I mean, it was a double-edged sword because people love the lockdown. I mean, when they're getting paid to love it anyway. Yeah. And it also revealed to any bad actor, I mean, like, you know, somebody wants to do a bad thing, not somebody who's in Emmerdale Farm, but like it revealed to any future government, if we get like, you know, a more authoritarian government than we've got now, that people will put up with a lot. They will put up with a lot of restrictions on their freedom. So China will be looking at that for when they invade in like 12 years' time.
Well, I mean, but that's the point, is that what once had was unprecedented now has precedence. And so the idea that if this is how we behave, at the, you know, still in restrictions based on this new strain that, as you say, is not very lethal, et cetera, I mean, how can we not do this every winter? That's the thing. And of course, the fact that there isn't that much pushback is an authoritarian, has revealed a sort of rather grim authoritarian streak in across Europe, you know?
Yeah, and Australia as well. All the countries that, you know, you traditionally associate with people, you know, really not giving a fuck or, you know, really being sort of anti-establishment, actually have the strictest and harshest rules, like Scotland, Ireland and Australia.
Yeah, yeah. I play football with a bunch of lads from Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, stuff like this, Nigeria, and they're literally like, you guys are too rich. You fucking, my mate from Casablanca, he says to me, he goes, you can't farm today, we can't eat tomorrow. That's it. And he goes, if the government tried to do this, the people would be on the streets and they'd be done. They turn it on its head.
Yeah.
But you guys are too rich, too comfortable, too middle class, too safe. Yeah. And he's just right. MR is just exactly right. And I'm just like,
So many modern problems. Not just the fact that we can have a sort of 24-month lockdown, but you know, all the things that people stress about, like critical race theory, having 438 genders or whatever. It's all a symptom of people just having too much time to sit and think. And also, you know, people always want to slay a dragon. So, you know, fair enough, in the 50s, the 60s, with the civil rights movement, you know, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, these were genuine things that needed to change. They've pretty much changed now. You know, I'm not saying society is perfect, but, you know, all equality and equal rights written into law. And it's, you know, certainly written into most of society as well. You know, if you walked down the street or went to a pub and started, you know, saying racist stuff, people would be like, what the fuck, you get thrown out, you know what I mean? It's not accepted.
People still think
that, like, you know, there's these huge problems with race. In fact, they think it's getting worse. So they're still going around trying to, like, you know, fight it, but now it's like somebody tweeting something that's misinterpreted instead of, you know, a lynching. The stuff that they think is, you know, so awful is nowhere near as bad as it was, or is just completely misinterpreted, so that they've got an excuse to get their sword out and try and kill a dragon.
I think a lot of it is class, to be honest, and it's something that most people don't want to talk about that much. But I think it is a class thing. I think it's middle class people or upper middle class people who've been through academia, who don't really know many working class people. Like, say, for example, during the lockdown, the pajama party people, you know, the sort of middle class people who could just pad around their PJs all day, who were like, "Oh, what are you talking about going back to work?" They weren't a taxi driver from an inner city area of Dublin with four kids who were living on the breadline, who had to go out. Like they're so removed from those people now. And that's behind Brexit, that's behind all this, a lot of stuff in the UK, but it's just like this lack of understanding of, and so you have people on the woke new left, and I would say I would call myself old left, like 80s old left, in the sense that, you know, you're talking about housing, healthcare, that kind of stuff, education, like real stuff, but the new people who are on the side of what we call the sort of new left or whatever, they seem to me to be so removed, and I think it's because of the screen, because of spending all their time on a screen, so removed from old school working class people that their attitude to them, you know, this kind of paternalistic, almost colonial attitude of you're not in your right mind to, you know, don't you know the risk? And you're like, and you're trying to tell them, well, these people have four kids living in a house with no garden. They need to go out and work, and an empty street with no, you know, people outside, no, who can get a fucking taxi? But you know what I mean?
Yeah, so working class people. So if you worked in Tesco, well, there's no furlough for you. There's 80% of your salary while you're playing PlayStation. And Tesco people, nobody's coming out and clapping for them. They were like behind the counter when everybody's like supposed to be dropping, bodies are piling high in the streets. They're still there for like, you know, whatever, minimum wage, stacking shelves. So there's no fun furlough for them. And working class people historically have always sort of borne the brunt of So Brexit, for example, was a response to the mass immigration that we saw in the UK. And immigration, obviously, you know, is a good thing. I technically emigrated from Scotland. My fiancé emigrated from Ireland. You know, I've lived in other countries. I think the movement of people is a good idea, but it's got to be done sensibly. And also, I think, you know, society should do work to make sure that the benefits are spread out more. And the negative impacts are spread out more. So if you're working class, say you're a builder, and you've got, you know, a wife and three kids and two cars and a mortgage to pay, you've got a lot of overheads. So if guys from the Ukraine, and I've worked as a labourer, I've worked alongside guys from the Ukraine, and, you know, great guys and stuff, but they're living three to a room in a rented house. So their overheads were tiny. So they could obviously afford to undercut the cost of the British builders. And the benefits are going, so the benefits of that cheap labour are going to people with wealth, people who spend the money, people are buying the, you know, paying for the conservatories and the loft extensions and stuff. So they're going to middle class people. And the negative impact is being borne by working class people. And also working class people, you know, bear the impact of pressure on public services. And you know, the sort of social upheaval, the change. So your local spa turns into a Polsky sklep, and you've got to learn how to eat cabanos. And even though immigration overall brings a lot of benefits, like, I think people really didn't understand. They thought Brexit was about, you know, people just being racist. It's like, no, people, you know, it's like people say footballers are racist. Like, how come for decades, you know, so many people in football was like one of the original places where black people were accepted, because, you know, it turns out they're better at football.
But it did take
overall, so there's lots of black players.
It did take a long, I mean, and we could say that the, maybe not in the 70s and early 80s, but by, you know, it took a long time, but it did change, you know, especially with football. But the odd thing,
in the 70s, you know, people think, you know, football was this, you know, incredibly racist thing in the 70s, and it was. But I mean, there's different levels of racism, and certainly, I think denying people employment is a form of racism. If you're discriminating against black people and denying them employment, that's a very sort of, and it's got a, you know, a quantitative impact.
Well, you know, the sign, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish. So.
So Millwall in the 70s had more black players than the Guardian had black journalists. And the Guardian's this, you know, beacon of, you know, righteous leftism and equality. But they don't put their money where their mouth is. You know, they didn't have the black journalists. I think that's an example of, you know, working class. And purely from a sort of capitalist point of view, because Millwall knew, if we get these players, they're going to play better. Than, you know, compared to the other. So they weren't putting their racist ideology above anything else. They wanted to make money. They wanted to have a good team. Whereas the Guardian were happy to be subtly racist.
I mean, I played football for years in rough as guts, Northside Dublin football leagues. I always played football and stuff. And there was this big furore maybe 10 years ago. It was just, 7 or 8 years ago, about, you know, terrorist chanting and the inherent racism of the locker room. I guess it was just part of the sort of what was supposed to be our misogynistic misandry or whatever that was evident in the locker room. And I remember meeting a journalist or whatever and going, well, I play football with these people, against these people. I've never heard this kind of stuff. And like, you realize that all the people who were writing about it, of course, had never been to a football match to see whatever. And I go and watch see Bohemians in Dublin and stuff, you know. And you realize that all these people had just never really either been in a locker room or been to see any of these things. So, and I think that's still evident now in a lot of things that are written. I think the pandemic and the sort of post-Trumpism has sort of accelerated an idea that, well, if it isn't true what we write, it could be. And if it's part of the crusade, then it's righteous, and therefore it doesn't matter if it's sort of not really true. That's a rather messy sentence, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, you saw it with, I mean, it's the anniversary today of the Capitol Hill riots.
Yeah.
And they're painted in the media as this, you know, it was a coup. Trump tried to take down the government. It's like, man, like, there's no way a few guys in, like, Viking helmets are going to take down the American government. That's just a ridiculous narrative to play. I mean, obviously, they shouldn't have done it. It was terrible. Like, people died on the day. Policemen committed suicide afterwards. Yeah. But, I mean, it was to paint it as a coup. Because America's got it's got a history of being involved in coups.
Yeah.
And they never send in, you know, what looks like a stag do. They always send in, like, tanks and, like, Apache helicopters and, you know, guns and tanks.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to countries in Central America and South America and, places where coups involved, rather more than that, you know. But it's, again, it's just the misappropriation of a word to get more clicks, to say it's storming a coup rather than what it really was, which was high farce and high treason. That's kind of
exactly.
That's what I said it was at the time, you know, in one of the podcasts. Yeah. Whatever, storming.
And also, I felt it was in the context of, you know, there'd been months and months and months of Antifa and Black Lives Matter riots where they were smashing up businesses, you know, burning homes and businesses and cars, assaulting people. And I mean, I thought, you know, this riot was sort of given credence or given, you know, allowed to happen because of that. You know, because of the context of that happening. And also, I can't remember what I was going to say. But there was another thing I was going to say.
Well, it's interesting you mention Antifa because, I mean, we in the metal scene know them. I mean, I have friends in the old Antifa from the 90s, but the metal scene was quite familiar with Antifa in 2000, mid-90s or whatever. So we could, when they popped up again, behind all this stuff, having toured America, you know, like when you play in Portland, when you play in whatever, of course, you're going to meet people from the sort of left metal scene. And it was quite interesting that all of a sudden they became this, you know, kind of, there was this sort of celebrity status attached to them. And it was like, oh, we know these guys from 20, 25 years ago when they would brush shoulders in the metal scene, sort of policing what was going on in the metal scene, you know. And it sort of, again, was a sort of interesting thing to observe how, you know, the sort of canary in the coal mine of our extreme music culture 20 years ago slipped into the mainstream 15, 20 years ago later. You know?
Yeah, so when you talk about, like, Antifa 25 years ago sort of policing the metal scene.
Maybe let's say 15, 20, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah. So is that sort of what you're talking about with the, you know, the almost like the cultural revolution in metal and, you know, middle class people coming in and imposing their values on the scene?
A little bit. It's the middle class people slipped into the scene anyway. And then I say into the heavy metal, if you look at Iron Maiden or something like that, to me, they're working class heroes. The Clash aren't.
Yeah.
They're mid, you know, they're public.
Oh, yeah. Boys. Clash went to art school.
Yeah.
So same as Sex Pistols went, you know. Yeah.
But whereas Iron Maiden were just working class lads from the East End. So heavy metal always had a working class route to it. And I think that in a way, to me at least, some punks may disagree, but punk kind of envied that in a way. and they sort of emulated, but sort of change, especially metal, black metal in the 90s, late 90s. But certainly, the Antifa something was a name we would have known these people in 96, 97, 98. And of course, the old left movement in Ireland, I knew many punks in the 80s. And stuff. I used to go to punk squats in 89 and 90 to see gigs. And so when there was a genuine social wedge behind some of the things, you know, that I would have agreed with, you know, I would have known those people. But as you say, some part of it, again, was a sort of middle class post-art student academic slide into our scene, which then decided to tell us what was and wasn't acceptable. And we could see the thing happening, which I think happened in comedy 10, 15 years previous, or a version of it, or at least the Antifa becoming such a, like, on the name of, or, you know, on the lips of the President of the United States just seemed so oddly incongruous if we went back to 2000 or 98 and thought about it. It's just so bizarre, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if there was a question there or just a sort of random ramble, but, you know. But the metal scene sort of had that sort of view into this before, you know.
Yeah. But the image of Antifa, certainly the image that I've got, bear in mind that I'm mates with Andy Noe, it's not a sort of positive one. Whereas, you know, stuff that I listened to in the 90s, like Sonic Youth would be, you know, the Youth Against Fascism and stuff like that was a much more sort of positive. I mean, now Antifa seem to be railing against something that doesn't really exist. There aren't, I mean, everybody's calling Trump a fascist, and he's not a fascist. He's just a cool guy who likes to party. And, you know, and like...
Well, I mean, in the early 80s, you would have had bands like Crass and Conflict, the sort of anarcho-punk early scene where that came from. And that I would, understand, you know, that was also railing against things like Hunt Saboteuring. And there was a sort of, you know, there was a sort of early vegetarian movement and all that kind of stuff. And there was old leftist movements enshrined in that early 80s anarcho-punk scene, which I would have, you know, respected. But somehow it morphed into, I'm not really sure what it is now. It seems to be so removed from its working class roots again, like kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, all
like
the everything. Ones. All the ones that I see getting like arrested and stuff, and the police mugshots I see, they're all like, you can tell they've got some weird gender. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They've got the blue hair, they've got nose piercings, they've got no money, they've got an OnlyFans, they shit in the street, they take drugs, and they're not people. I don't want them near my children or my pets.
But I think it also points to the huge mental health crisis in the States as well, though, that which was bizarrely enough caused by big pharma and opioids as well, that there are so many people who just are so fucked and outside the system who are just like going, oh, great, a protest, let's roll along to that, you know?
Right. And it provides a sort of community for them.
Yeah, in a way, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, I mean, we're sort of... We're living in times. I mean, I guess, you know, I'm lucky because I say I'm lucky because, you know, I can deal with stuff and I don't have mental health problems. Maybe. But I mean, at the same time, Jesus Christ, if these people can't make a living for themselves in a free, stable capitalist society like America, man, they'd be dead in a ditch and under a communist society, you know what I mean? Living under communism, like, you know, they seem to think it's this panacea that's going to deliver all this, like, wonderful stuff. And it's like, no, communism is a complete feudal hierarchical power structure.
Yeah.
You've got to constantly be managing, you know, upwards managing relationships and making sure you don't speak out of place. I mean, the first person to stop clapping at Stalin's speeches would get a visit from the KGB. It wasn't a pleasant free society at all.
No, and I mean, having spent a lot of, you know, toured a lot of those countries, spent a lot of time, even 20 years ago, playing, you know, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, Serbia, being in Ukraine, being in Russia a whole bunch of times. And I mean, I would say to some, you know, to my 20-year-old cousin who's in college, like, you need to go to Russia, speak to some Russians, or let's say go to Romania and see how do you feel about Ceausescu? Or speak to people who lived under it, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, especially those countries, and see, well, how do you feel about this? That's not really something they really want to do, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there are advantages. That I was in Belarus a couple of years back, and so this is before Lukashenko sort of hit the skids.
Yeah, yeah.
People by then everything was stable, and people seemed to be accepting of their dictator rather than opposed them. But everything was super neat and tidy.
Yeah.
I remember there was one night this tramp was trying to get into our apartment block, and you know, obviously like a homeless guy. I started talking to him, spoke like perfect English, had a physics degree, and he was so polite. And he was like, "I'm very sorry for trying to break into your house." You know, like, so it's not like the tramps you get in Glasgow at all.
No.
So,
no.
Yeah.
Well, actually, speaking of Glasgow, I was in Glasgow in November. I played there with another band. And having spent a lot of time in Glasgow and Edinburgh over the years before that, I don't understand the SNP thing. And Scottish people that I know, I don't understand how they seem to be in power, and also how Scotland is. What happened to Scotland that it's chosen this authoritarian route? I when I was in Glasgow, it felt like the soul had been just ripped out of the place. The rules and regulations were so much more extreme than in England.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of threads to it, but basically, the SNP they're a single issue party. I mean, Nigel Farage based his campaign on the SNP. So the SNP, because they're a devolved parliament, they're constantly fighting against Westminster. Anything that goes wrong, they can blame on Westminster. Anything that goes well, they can take credit for themselves. And Scotland itself is really suffering under the SNP. So educational standards have plummeted. Used to be, you know, some of the best in Europe. Health outcomes, drug abuse, drug deaths. It was always bad in Scotland. Yeah. But there's a lot of progress made in the sort of early noughties and stuff. In the 14 years of SNP rule, drug deaths are now 3.5 times higher than the rest of the UK.
You also have the lowest, don't you? Average male life expectancy isn't it 58? It's come down like 3 or 4 years in the last, or 60.
Yeah,
it's come down 4 or 5 years in the last few.
But yeah, which is shocking. There's a real poverty of aspiration in Scotland, but also the SNP have bribed young Scots to stay in Scotland. So Scottish people used to leave, used to go to London, you know, study in English cities, and now the SNP say, well, if you stay in Scotland, you study in Scotland, we'll pay your tuition fees and pay your, you know, student loans and all the rest of it. So people stay in Scotland, they don't leave, and then, you know, if you study in Scotland, you're more likely to stay in Scotland. So then they've got this, like, the SNP is super woke. So people in Scotland think, oh, the Tories, they're evil. English people are evil. And, you know, it really foments this sort of parochial, inward-looking, real sort of negative nationalism. And for some reason, you know, English nationalism is seen, you know, recognised as a malign force. Whereas Scottish nationalism, because it's directed against the English, who are, you know, the oppressors, ostensibly, is seen as a good thing.
Yeah.
And I think I almost want Scotland to get independence because I know that within like 6 months it would be a disaster and the SNP would be absolutely hated, absolutely loathed. They wouldn't be able to blame things on England anymore. Wouldn't be able to blame things on Westminster. And I mean, what they've done to Scotland is, I mean, as a Scot, it's a tragedy. Scotland used to be, you know, such a creative place, such an outward looking place, and now it's, you know, I mean, Scotland used to run the UK. There was so many. I worked in government. I worked in policing, and you know, there's so many Scots, you know, throughout the military, throughout police, throughout government, like so many top, like Tony Blair. Nobody talks about it, but he was actually Scottish. Gordon Brown, obviously. You know, there's all these. And you know, Robin Cook. There's so many Scots.
Ah, Robin Cook. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't.
And now we've got Michael Gove, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And the next generation, they're all staying in Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, it was just so weird because I did a little tour. I do the bass in this other band called Dread Sovereign, and we did a little tour when England opened up there for a little bit. And when we went, we played in the UK, and then we went up to Scotland, and we were sent this messages by the venue. And one of the stipulations for playing there was if you talk about COVID, if you say anything against the mask mandates or anything remotely against the narrative of whatever this mainstream thing is, you will be pulled yeah. off the stage and your show cancelled and you will not be paid. It was in the
room. That's fucked up. That's like Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he was told, you know, if you say these words, you're going to get pulled. He literally was dragged off the stage by police and arrested. Yeah. And then hounded to his death.
Yeah, I mean, the reality was we showed up in our van and guy went, all right. And he just let us in and we played our gig and no one said a thing. So it's just, you know, that somebody on the third floor has written, well, we better put all these rules in.
Yeah,
but it was quite incredible that as soon as we drove across the border, it felt very, so very different than, you know, we played once on the South Coast, one show or whatever. And the difference between that and Glasgow, which used to be this fun, vibrant place. And not only did everybody have to have their vaccination passport to get into the gig, they also needed a test on top of that. And everyone was encouraged to distance, and everyone just 75 or 100 people stood there going, ugh, and then just filed out in sort of silence. And I was like, this is not the Glasgow I remember. And you realize that, like, I mean, this is what makes me very sad about what's happening. Well, one of the things is that before long, these situations just become learned, you know, sort of social attributes or whatever, not attributes, but whatever. And people just go, well, this is just how it is. They forget that it was different 3 years ago. And they go, well, we'll just file in single file, show three sets of papers to get in and go. And then we leave and the city's empty by 11. And I mean, my friends, to me, naive friends of mine still go, but why would a government want that? And I go, why would a government want more control for their city to not be? It's just...
Yeah.
I go, what the fuck are you talking about? Or why would they not want just a model showroom city where just rich people go to eat and all the rest of us are pushed to just stay inside? It, you know, people still can't compute that, at least to me. And I hope to be wrong. The other thing about it is, I mean,
the other thing, I mean, the government's making so much money from lockdown. Not the government, but government ministers. So, I mean, Transparency International, like 20% of COVID contracts are dodgy or, you know, potentially corrupt. So Owen Paterson, you know, nearly brought down Boris. He's getting backhanders. He's working for Randox, the PCR testing company. Yeah. And so they're paying him and they get the government contracts. So, you know, Matt Hancock's former pub landlord got a contract to make, you know, PPE or something like that. And, you know, there's all this, you know, all this, people are all getting, you know, backhanders and stuff. So you can see where the incentive to have this, you know, the absolute power to, you know, skip a tendering process, the absolute power to, you know, hand out taxpayers' money to your friends.
Yeah, of course.
It's very, very enticing.
Of course. But so you, I mean... There's a new kind of comedian, right? Which is the ones who were YouTubers, then comedians, and sort of vice versa. They went from YouTubers to being, and they sort of make their main, I think, living from Patreon and YouTube. I mean, how are you able to sort of survive as a touring comedian? I mean, I was a touring musician. It's not, I can't do it at the moment. I mean, until hopefully summer festival season comes back, then we'll start playing festivals, but we can't tour. But are you able to do a comedy circuit now in the UK, or how does it work?
Yeah, I mean, I used to just go around doing
or what?
No, I used to go around doing all the clubs. You know, so you can either do club sets or you can do your own show. So, you know, if I went out to Southeast Asia, Australia, or comedy festivals like the Edinburgh Fringe, I'd do my solo show, and an hour. And
but in the pandemic,
during the pandemic, I went to Dubai because they didn't have a lockdown there. I was stranded in Australia for the first lockdown, so I came back in like June of 2021. Right. 2020, and then but I went into politics. I met up with Lawrence Fox and stood as a representative of his Reclaim party in Glasgow. Okay. Stood against the Humza Yousaf, who was the justice minister at that time.
What was your experience with that?
His hate crime bill. So basically Scotland brought through this hate crime bill that criminalises conversation. Yeah, it's shocking piece of legislation.
It would criminalise this conversation,
Oh, yeah, literally. And like, you know, and you're living under fear because everything's down to perception. And there's very little sort of objectivity. and you know the burden of proof on a joke. You know, how do you police a joke? How do you prove that you're being ironic?
So tell me about this though. That's quite interesting. So how did you? I mean, I know Lawrence Fox, and I know you've been involved in podcasts, The Lotus Eaters, and that kind of stuff. But how did you?
Yeah.
What was your experience in trying to step into that sort of legal political realm?
Well, I mean, I used to work. I was a government consultant. I was a criminal intelligence analyst. So I've got experience of working government, writing speeches for politicians, and all the rest of it. Doing analysis to guide policy and stuff. So I've always been interested in government and things like that. And then I quit to just shout dick jokes at drunk people for a while. But I had a subscription to The Economist and stuff. So Lawrence got accused of being racist, and his whole life was just completely just blown up. You know, he went from being a really well-paid actor,
right?
And he didn't say anything racist. Expressed an opinion that was fairly reasonable. Yeah. And he's quite a a mischievous person. So he's not somebody to doff his cap and bow down at woke people. So he's very irreverent. But I mean, I like that. The woke people seem to see that as blasphemy, and wanted to destroy his life for it. So I saw that and I thought, man, that's ridiculous. A similar thing happened to me. Somebody in the comedy industry called me racist, and based on nothing. Basically, I went on Radio 4 and I was talking about the lack of working class representation in comedy. Because on Radio 4, I can get away with being working class. In Scotland, I'm upper middle class. But, and it caused loads of problems for me. And it was just some posh, useless comedy industry person calling me racist to try and look cool in front of her friends.
Yeah.
So that, that pissed me off. And she was a member of the Live Comedy Association, which is this sort of statutory body. It's been set up to regulate comedy because if there's something that's going to make comedy funnier, it's having a government body regulating it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I complained to them. I ended up getting issued with a certificate saying that I'm not racist, and they said I could show it to any promoter if they was worried that I was racist. I'm like, wow, that's really going to help. You know what I mean? They showed up, hey, here's my certificate saying I'm not racist. They're going to be like, why have you got this? You know, what did you do?
This is such crazy stuff.
Yeah, so I got in touch with Lawrence and met up with him, and we worked on a lot of policy and a lot of ideas, and he's a friend, and I'm not as involved with the party anymore because comedy started up, I've got a lot of time for a lot of respect for what he's trying to do, and I think he's much maligned and misrepresented.
Sure.
But actually running for election was an interesting experience because the SNP have got a hugely well-funded machine behind them. We didn't have that. So the SNP could afford to send out multiple mail shots. We could afford to send out one mail shot. And a generic one, not a targeted one. But basically every household in Glasgow would get a leaflet with me on it, spelling out my policy and explaining why the hate crime bill is bad. And the advisors to the party said, you've got to use a Scottish printer because it'll look bad if it's printed in Essex, because you've got to have the name of the printer on it as part of the electoral rules. There's some sort of screw up between the printer and the Royal Mail. Bear in mind that the people who own businesses in Scotland told me, don't use a Scottish printer because the SNP controls so much of the Scottish economy. So much of it is, a much bigger proportion of the Scottish economy is public sector than in England. That businesses in Scotland don't want to be seen to be doing something that's hurting the SNP. The Royal Mail in Scotland, that's a public sector. That's part of the public sector. That's part of the government. Effectively, the SNP have been very clever at making parts of the executive, the public sector, bringing them under government control, making them almost a branch of the SNP. So the police used to be broken up in separate areas across Scotland, Now they've just been centralised into Police Scotland, and it's all, you know, sort of much more tightly controlled by the SNP. So then when, you know, somebody who's spoken out against the SNP, like Marion Miller, they can send, you know, stormtroopers down there to terrify them in front of their children. So basically my mail shot didn't go out. And it was a screw up on our part, but there must have been some. I suspect something malicious happened for that mail shot not to go out.
I'm just really fascinated because I spend a lot of time in Scotland before, and I mean, if you take Irish history or you take Sinn Féin or something, you know, which was, you know, essentially the political wing of the IRA, which is, you know, which sort of holds 20-25-30% of the votes in the last election, and everyone else jumped into bed together to try and stop them getting into power. Now, fuck knows what they would have done during the pandemic, but there is a very particular line through Irish political history, through, you know, the Civil War and all this kind of stuff. I just, what I don't understand is that for a lot of Irish people, now maybe not so much in Dublin, although I, you know, there is of course a percentage of that, the historical lineage to, let's say, the nationalistic, anti-imperialist, anti-English ideal is quite, like, it's a very simple thing to observe. I don't understand how the SNP has somehow this sort of power over over Scotland that it does. Like, maybe as an Irish person, because, you know, there was bombings and there was whatever, all this kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to claim that I was born in Belfast or something like this, but there is a very distinct historical lineage which I don't really understand. I'm going to get pelters now from my Scottish friends, but I kind of don't really understand how they seem to have so much of a, is it an emotional, romantic grip over Scottish people? Or just a simple fear of the borough? So I don't really understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of perfect storm, because there's no opposition. There's no organised, you know, credible opposition in Scotland. Like, the Tories are probably going to get wiped out at the next election. Their vote was basically based on not being the SNP.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they don't have a strong leader. Labour have completely been, you know, just wiped out. And they used to have, you know, the Labour vote has really gone across to the SNP, which is a shame. Alex Salmond set up a new party called ALBA, and that didn't really work out.
Bad name.
Yeah. Isn't that, it's like a brand of a shit TV that you get in Argos.
Yeah, it's like a shit TV from fucking Made in Romania or something. It's like, it's
yeah. Even worse, it could be made in Scotland.
So the SNP
have got this thing, you know, they're a single issue party essentially. So they got this thing of, you know, we're not the Tories, you know, we're for Scottish independence, and Scottish independence is held up as this, you know, oh, if you get independence, everything's going to be perfect because England's ruining Scotland and that's why things are bad. Obviously, if Scotland ever got independence, they'd quickly realise that England is the only thing funding all the things that are failing in Scotland, and you know, the SNP would be voted out pretty sharpish. But yeah, they are a single-issue party. They've also had 14 years in power, so they've shown... thing is, because they're funded, they're propped up by the UK government, which, depending on your calculations, subsidises them to the tune of 15 billion or 36 billion beyond what the Scottish tax take is. Because they're propped up by all that sort of Westminster largesse, they can paper over all the cracks. They can paper over all the corruption and all the mistakes that they make. So people haven't, you know, really had their eyes open to the fact that, and there hasn't been that, you know, that single catastrophic thing. A lot of, like you're saying, the life expectancy has been, you know, gradually decreasing. Health outcomes are decreasing. Drug abuse is getting worse. Education is getting worse. The public services are getting worse. The roads in Glasgow are shocking. You know what I mean? But there hasn't been that one cataclysmic thing that's, you know, it's going to break. I thought the Alex Salmond inquiry could possibly have been it, but it wasn't. So, you know, in the background, because most people don't pay that much attention to politics, you know, Nick Sturgeon gives the appearance of doing an all right job. And, you know, during lockdown, she had her daily broadcast, which she managed to politicize and, you know, make it as a sort of selling platform for the SNP. So She's been dealt a good hand and she's played it pretty well.
Yeah. My favorite Scottish comedian is Jerry Sadovitz.
Yeah, mine too.
What happened to him on, you can't find anything of him on YouTube or something. Is that the Jimmy Savile effect? Or, oh, he took it down. Is that what it is? Okay.
He took it down himself, apparently. So, and it's a shame. He's a real perfectionist. So I've been to see him a few times, and I saw him once at the Leicester Square Theatre. This must be years ago now, like 10 years ago, maybe. And he was filming a DVD, and the show was amazing. It was like just amazing. I was dying laughing, just dying laughing. And then he decided not to put it out. He said it wasn't good enough.
That's bizarre.
So, he's a perfectionist.
But how did you then get involved? Sorry, I'm keep pivoting a few things. But how did you get involved with the podcast of the Lotus Eaters and all that kind of stuff? Just through the Lawrence?
Oh, they just got in touch. Well, yeah, I had dinner with, it was me, Lawrence, Andy Noe, and Carl Benjamin. So very much a sort of Axis of Evil meeting. And
that would make you Japan or Italy or...
I'm trying to think who would be who. I can't say who would be who without being racist. But but yeah, like Carl. I mean, I love Carl. He's another very mischievous person. And I love how he winds people up. I don't agree with him on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But man, I love what they've done, and they're stepping in and providing what all these people are doing, like Lotus Eaters, Trigonometry. They're stepping in and providing entertainment and a service for people. I mean, Lotus Eaters is way beyond entertainment; it's like history and politics and everything. But they're providing stuff that isn't catered for anyway. Yeah. Like if you turn on BBC Comedy, it's people dressed up as bananas or whatever, try to throw donuts in a hat, like man, Chris Rock wouldn't do that.
No, or
it's ridiculous. It's not.
Or Frankie Boyle's what is his show? His terrible show.
Oh, New World Order. Oh my god. Oh my god. Just bad. And they don't get that they're the ones with the cultural power. They think, you got these, and they're all Oxbridge educated. Yeah. The people, Sophie Duker, Oxbridge educated. Yeah. Incredibly wealthy background, parents in media or whatever, our path into comedy was.
He has to sit at home at night and look himself in the mirror and go, "What the fuck happened? What the fuck happened to me?" Or whatever.
Does he?
I don't know. He has to be.
Does he think he's actually doing? Does he think he's actually doing the right thing? Because dictators, for example. Dictators convince themselves that they're doing the right thing. Dictators convince themselves that they are the savior, the superhuman savior of their country, while they're oppressing their people. So people, construct narratives in their head to suit their own situation. So I think that's what he might be doing. But BBC Comedy, man, it's a load of shite. But it's great. It's great that it is, because then people go to my YouTube channel. I'm up to like 26,000 subscribers now. People come and watch my videos instead.
Yeah, I mean, but do you find that how easy is it to book or not book shows? I mean, are there enough clubs in the UK that will just go, all right, like literally, by now you can plot a graph. We just ignore that club because the bookers won't have us, and we just plot the ones that we like and we bring our audience. I mean, is that kind of how it goes? In the heavy metal terms, in the music terms, there's a festival culture which is so big that literally, if you're big enough, it doesn't matter. If you're a band that only brings 50 to 100 people, people might complain. But if you bring 800 people or 1,000 people, that's a lot of beer behind the bar. Nobody's cancelling Slayer, for example. Nobody's cancelling Amon Amarth or whatever, so... Money talks in that sense, but for a comedian who's putting 25 to 125 bums on seats or whatever you want to call it, how much pushback do you get?
The thing is, if you're doing like a club set, you're not really bringing the audience in. You're only bringing the audience in if it's your solo show,
right?
And then you're pushing it on your social media, you're trying to get people in. So, you know, I do a solo show about once a month at Top Secret Comedy in London. Right. And yeah, I mean, there's some places that don't book me anymore, like the Comedy Store, which, yeah. You know, certainly used to be the sort of the one everybody wanted to get into. Yeah. They don't book me. And that honestly, that genuinely pains me.
Sure.
But I mean, I don't think it's because of politics, or it might be because of politics. I think it's because the last of us there, I died on my ass. So, I die on my ass like once a year, and it just so happened I did it at the Late Show at the Comedy Store. Right. But I mean, Top Secret, man, I gigged there last night, and that's, in my opinion, and I think, you know, a lot of comedians' opinions, the best club probably in the universe. Right. And if they ever stop booking me, I don't know what I'd do. But yeah, I mean, I can still get plenty of gigs. But I really want to focus on. I mean, I love gigging, but it's there. If you're a club comedian, there's a sort of limit on, you know, where you can go creatively and also how much money you can make. Whereas doing YouTube videos, I'm talking about stuff different each time. And it's fun, and then, you know, you can make money, and also, you know, I'm getting married in a couple of months, so I don't want to be driving to Hull and, you know, spending all night and getting back at like 4 a.m. up my wife and kids, you know. I want to just do it in front of a camera in the living room, and then upload it, and it's done.
That's the complete antithesis of the musical thing with the band, the idea that there's no streaming reality for bands or whatever. So the traditional, you know, analog method of getting in the van, going out and tour, etc., which is now more or less removed. That's the sort of lifeblood of being in a band or playing, you know, heavy metal, whatever you want to call it, that can't be replicated by streaming, which sort of makes me very worried that these are like this is the final chapter for bands being able to, you know, especially if they're climate lockdown and traveling, etc., and carbon footprints come in, this kind of lifestyle will be something that belongs in the 80s and the 90s or whatever, you know. Whereas I speak to comedians and they're they're all right, but like, with bands on YouTube, you know.
Yeah, and I think with bands, it's you've got like four guys, you've got all that kit, you've got to get everybody together and in the same van. With comedy, it's much easier to sort of, you drop out, people dropped out, they got jobs as Amazon drivers or landscape gardeners or whatever, and then it's very easy to just, you know, then come back to comedy. Yeah. So also with comedy, it's much, you know, just even when times are good, even with no lockdown, it's, you know, there's much fewer overheads. All it is a guy and a microphone. There's no, you know, you don't need like somebody tuning off a drum kit and all this expensive equipment and, you know, all these, you know, four guys to feed. Yeah. I think comedy's always sort of had that advantage.
So you guys are just before us in the sort of holding pen that may be allowed out from lockdown. We're the sort of, I think we've, the last, the unicorn that's left, you know, in the holding pen that may be left out.
And I guess comedy, you know, comedy was easier to do in distance venues. So Top Secret had, they put Perspex feet between each row.
Yeah.
And, you know, reduced the capacity a bit. In other places, you know, you'd see it, you'd have, you know, somebody here and then, you know, a gap of two seats and somebody there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's harder to do that if it's, you know, when it's music, people want to jump up and down. You know, especially, you know, heavy metal.
Anything punk, rock indie, whatever, etc. Even dance music. Even my friends who are into dance music and all that kind of stuff are like, look, we'll hire a warehouse in the middle of the Midlands in Ireland, bring a sound system, and we'll fucking invite people by text, etc. Very hard to do that with bands, to find a place to go that is somehow under the radar, and then go to everyone, hey, can you all turn your phones off? And, you know, it's a rather, you feel like a rather endangered species, you know what I mean? I don't know though. well, sir, I think that's a good moment to do a pause. It's like an hour and 20.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.